I don't know what you thought you were going to get into when you wandered in here today, but... Yeah. I want to explore with you a set of ideas that have been germinating in my head for a long time and that came to fruition this last spring, having to do with the concept of victims. I've been teaching for about 20 years now, and teaching college students, and I can't begin to tell you how many times classroom discussions of social problems have come to an impasse over the old free will determinism controversy. We start talking about poverty, the causes, the cures, and as we explore one thing after another and debate back and forth, we come down somehow to the question of choice. Do people choose their situations, or are they caught in situations that they cannot control? Because I was thinking about this last night, and of course during Vespers, the free will versus determinism thing came up again. Al just referred to it briefly in passing. I think he handled it in about the only way you can handle it. I'm not going to try to resolve that problem this morning. It seems to me that if we think it through rationally, we become determinists. The only problem with that is that you can't remain a consistent determinist. The very process of thinking denies determinism. There's a kind of a paradox in a determinist trying to persuade people to be determinists. Or when a determinist says, science has now established that all human behavior is controlled by genetics and environmental conditioning, he forgets that science itself presupposes freedom, the pursuit of truth. Anyway, come back to the problem. When I'd be talking about unemployment to my students, and we would hang up on the question of whether unemployment is voluntary or involuntary, and then we would get into that terrible controversy about free will versus determinism. Well, this happened so many times that I realized that I was tired of letting this end the discussion. And I began wondering whether there wasn't something to be learned from the fact that we always came aground on this particular shoal. Now to begin with, let me tell you where I always started out. I am an economist, and economists professionally, by virtue of the theoretical framework that they have ingested, they think that people always choose their actions, that if a person takes an action, it's because he chose it. The theory that we use to explain the world presupposes that. Of course, that doesn't mean that it's true, but it does mean that I am conditioned to think that way. Economists don't suppose that everybody has equally good choices, but they do assume that people choose. And I find this way of thinking absolutely indispensable. I can't do without it. I can't make any sense out of the social world unless I assume that people take the actions they take because they've chosen them. Maybe from among a rotten array of alternatives. You know, maybe your options are to die, to cut off your right arm, or to murder your children. I would say those are rotten alternatives. But that's a bad example. I'm trying to stress the fact that I'm not saying, see, with the unemployment problem, I get into this dilemma all the time. I argue that there is no such thing as involuntary unemployment, that the people whom the Bureau of Labor Statistics counts as unemployed are people who have chosen not to take particular jobs that are available to them. And then I immediately go on and I say, now that doesn't mean that they're lazy or that they're shiftless or irresponsible. If I were to lose my job today, I would not go out tomorrow and take the first job that I could find, which would probably be working in McDonald's. I would wait and look for something better, and it would be wise to do so. It would be socially responsible for me to do that. But it does me no good to put in all of these disclaimers. I go back and say, in the Great Depression, I am asserting that 13 million people were unemployed by choice. because they chose not to work at the jobs that were available to them. Then I say, but they had rotten choices. Perhaps the best choice they had was to go out and sell apples for a penny a day. And their time is worth more than that. It would make more sense for them to go out and hunt, make more sense to work around the house. So, but my point, I say, is that people choose. Well, it doesn't do me any good. I always get blasted by my liberal friends. And the phrase that they use against me is, you're blaming the victim. I have not read the book titled Blaming the Victim, and I'm not going to read the book. I'm so mad at the book. I know that there are some cases where we do. I have a tendency. I'll speak for myself. If I pick on somebody, if I'm unfair to someone, I'm uncomfortable with this. I don't like to accept the responsibility for having been unfair. So I have a tendency to blame that person. That's if I yell at my wife, and then I go into my bedroom, you know, feeling all righteous. I start thinking about how good I am and how bad she is and how she deserved to be yelled at. I think there is a tendency in human beings to do this. And we're familiar with the way in which the police have treated people, women who have been raped, you know, and defense attorneys have cross-examined them. Well, it wouldn't have happened if you weren't, you know, this sort of thing. Surely we do tend to put the blame on people in order to avoid the consequences of maybe accepting the blame ourselves. I'm not denying any of that. But I'm very uncomfortable with the idea that there are victims. And I don't think that to accuse someone of blaming the victim is a definitive squelch at all. I am extremely uncomfortable with an idea that goes along with this way of thinking, which is that society is at fault. I've asked myself the question for a long time. Why are my liberal friends so eager to blame society rather than to blame individuals? I mean, you know, think of poor people, criminals, unemployed, people on welfare, drug addicts, alcoholics. These people today, by liberals, are all called victims. And society tends to be blamed for the problems that these people are encountering. Why do liberals characteristically like to blame society? It's not, in my judgment, because liberals deny the concept of personal guilt and responsibility. If you listen to them blaming society, you will find out that they are really blaming corporation executives, Richard Nixon, the white males, the middle class, and they are very specific in assigning the burden of guilt and responsibility to these people. So it's not that that liberals deny any sense of personal responsibility. That would be very, very difficult to do consistently, because liberalism is a philosophy grounded on the sense of individual responsibility. I think the basic explanation is a very laudable preference for the underdog, a reluctance to say that a person who is in an unfortunate position is there because he chose it. We all instinctively hate the Yankees. Well, if you're my age, you hate the Yankees. Some of you are too young to remember that the Yankees used to always win in the American League. We root for the underdog. We want to elevate those who are down at the bottom. And of course, you can always find facts to support the thesis that, let's say an alcoholic is in that position because of something unfortunate that happened to him that would not have happened to him if society were differently constructed. You can always make out a case, a rational, logical, empirically well-grounded case, that unfortunate people are the victims of the society in which they were brought up. That's much better for those of us who prefer underdogs than saying it's their own fault. But this is a position that seems to me to be leading us into a terrible thicket. There are two things I would point out before getting into my problems with victim thinking of victims. First of all, A sense of personal responsibility is a very important constraint on behavior. And liberals aren't the only people who consume liberal rhetoric. During the, you know, I haven't seen the papers on the, I haven't seen enough reports on the recent looting in New York City. But if you go back to the riots of the 60s in the cities and take a look at the studies that were done, the interviews that were conducted, the police reports and all of that, of the young people that were picked up looting and rampaging, and you may be astonished and you may not be, but it is a fact that time after time these people said, it's not our fault. We were made that way. There are books and studies on the riots, articles just full of comments like that. If when liberals start saying that society is responsible for all ills, they are telling people, individuals, you are not responsible. Therefore, anything you do is okay because it's not your fault. This is the determinist's paradox. You know, one of the very important constraints on social behavior is a sense of individual responsibility. If that sense of individual responsibility disappears, then that constraint determining behavior disappears. If the determinist is correct, you know, that all our behavior is determined, one of the things that determines us is this belief that was inculcated in us that we are responsible personally for our actions. And when a different belief is inculcated in us, then that is no longer there to constrain us. And then what's left? Only the police. And the police can't be everywhere. Moreover, the police will also be irresponsible, won't they? A society in which no one is responsible is impossible. Even if the sense of personal responsibility were a total illusion, it is, it seems to me, an indispensable illusion. And our attacks upon it are very, very dangerous. A second thing I want to observe about this is that we don't know how to create a society in which no one feels deprived. We don't know how to do it. Even if we were to absolutely equalize the distribution of monetary income, many people would feel deprived. People with larger families would feel deprived. People who think they contribute more would feel deprived. We don't have the foggiest notion of how to construct a society in which no one will feel deprived. And so we had better be very, very careful about making feelings of deprivation into a license for the committing of unsocial acts. We are always going to have people, perhaps almost all of us, feeling deprived, feeling unjustly treated. And if the feeling that you have been unjustly treated is a license for antisocial behavior, then we are issuing a blanket license for antisocial behavior. All right, now, eventually a reaction begins against this kind of thinking. I trust you recognize what I'm talking about. Did you follow the papers too? You know to what extent we excuse the individual by blaming the society. The reaction sets in the form of law and order movements. Lock them up and throw away the key. There have been studies in Time magazine published one recently, and U.S. News and World Report had one, and there's some much better studies even that have recently been published on youth crime, gangs in the cities. I think you can, if you follow this at all, you begin to sense the reaction. For a long time, we treated people under 18 as if they were totally unresponsible for their actions. And the word got out on the streets. The prosecuting attorney over in Seattle made a speech recently in which he said, the kids on the streets are saying, be badass until you're 18 and then shape up. The Wall Street Journal, this is just evidence of a reaction setting, and recently did a piece on the front page on caning in Singapore. In Singapore, they have corporal punishment And for certain sorts of kinds of crime, you are caned. And it's a very artfully applied punishment. and that was a response. I'm sure that feature was put in there because people are looking for more effective ways of punishing. I noticed also, I don't remember where I read it, but some popular news magazine, may have been Time again, did a piece on the Islamic law recently. And, what you do with a thief, you cut off one hand. There was a report of five in Saudi Arabia, I think, or Yemen, or one of those countries, adopts the law of the Quran. Five men were convicted of rape. One of them was unmarried, and he was decapitated. The other four were married, and therefore they were also guilty of adultery, and they were put in sand up to their waist and stoned to death with small stones. But why is this currently being published in the news and being talked about? I think it's because the reaction is setting in, and I am not urging that we stone rapists or necessarily that we cane criminals, although I've often started interesting fights by suggesting that we restore corporal punishment in some cases. It's interesting to me how many people insist that corporal punishment is cruel and unusual punishment forbidden by the Constitution. That's interesting to think about. Putting a person in a cell is not. But I think that there's a better approach. And I would like us to consider deliberately discarding the concept of victim as useless at best and more often pernicious. Let's see if it's worthwhile eliminating the concept of victim from our thinking. There are no victims. Let's see what that means. First of all, I'd ask you to think about it subjectively. Try to remember some time when you felt you were the victim. Yeah. You were the victim. How did you feel? What did you do when you, a sense of yourself as victim? What effect does that have on your behavior? Well, I'm not gonna throw it open because we don't have enough time. But if I quit as early as I hope to quit, we can talk about it.
Hmm? You rebel.
All right, I think that maybe you do. I wonder whether victims rebel. Depends what you mean by rebel. What I do, I was started thinking about a couple of years when I was teaching at Southern Methodist University, where I was encouraged by some friends even to believe, and drifted by my own natural indolence into the belief that I was the victim. I was the good guy fighting for the cause of righteousness, and I had been victimized by wicked people. And the first thing that I'm aware of is self-pity. If I am a victim, I start feeling sorry for myself. And self-pity is never any good. It is destructive. It leads to, it led in my case, sometimes to resignation. You know, say, well, what can I do about it? I'm the victim. You know, they're all against me. It's a big conspiracy. All the power is coming down on me. But then mixed with something, well, you said rebellion. In my case, at least, and I think in many, many cases, it leads to unprincipled acts. Where I don't really fight effectively against the forces that are victimizing me, I just lash back and I perpetrate some new injustice and give the excuse that I was the victim of injustice. I slug my kid. See, why'd you do that? Because the boss was mean to me today. I did. I'm reporting on my own behavior, that my feelings of being a victim led me to self-pity, to resignation, to destructive resignation, and to unprincipled acts of retaliation, nastiness. And I fortunately came to realize that it was absurd to think of myself as a victim. I was not a victim. And that was one of the big steps in my growing discovery or suspicion that the concept of victim is useless. Fixation on one's status as victim diminishes one's power to act in the present for the sake of the future. You read it. If you think you're a victim, I say your power to act is diminished. Let me remind you that victim is the opposite of victor. Victor means conqueror. Victim means conquered. Is it ever useful for a person to think of herself as conquered? I am very hostile to Freudian analysis. I'm growingly hostile. And one time I was a big fan because it seems to me that Freudian analysis teaches people they are victims, that what they are in the present is determined by events in the past, and of course the past is unalterable. And so here you are trapped, the victim, the conquered one of your past. And how can you get free? Only if someone sets you free, i.e. your psychotherapist. I see a hand. I'd like to hold the comments. Do you want to?
What about the feeling of anger?
Well, I think anger can be constructive if it does not come out of a sense of being victim.
As a result of the act that occurs rather than being occurring against you, but the act itself, such as a physical attack, robbery, things that are not specifically with you, but are also occurring around you, of which you can accept as occurring, and you don't get personally angry at the person who did it, but you have this, you have a great deal of anger that's created within you. If you intellectualize, you can say, well, what are you angry at? You shove it down and let it go someplace else?
Well, in general, my sense of it is, I guess I don't think anger is very constructive either. I don't know. I have to check it out. Insofar as anger just leads me to lash out the way you do, you know, when you're in a straitjacket, you're the victim, all you do is and you don't get anywhere.
What do you do with it, though?
I think you... What do you do? Well, there are a variety of things to do with it. I think face it, recognize it, and recognize it. Honor it within yourself. Recognize that feeling is there, but don't be controlled by it. Don't let yourself become the victim of your own anger. I think we should never let ourselves become the victim of our emotions. And I don't think we will be the victim of our emotions if we're aware of our emotions. If we honor our emotions, we know they're in there. We don't feel guilty about them, we accept them, we look at them, and then we ask ourselves, what does the future require, rather than being caught up in the past. Well, let me hurry on. Hurry. I never do. I want to stress, we are all limited. When I say I don't think it's useful to think of anybody as victims, I'm not saying that everybody has equal power. That's certainly not true. We're all limited, and that's our destiny. But if we decide that we are also victims, then we're going to be looking to other people to deliver us. What else can we mean when we say we're victims? For example, think of a liberated woman, or a woman who thinks of herself as liberated, who is always talking about herself as the victim of her past socialization. Such a person, such a woman, I think, will tend to dwell in self-pity. She will constantly wait for others to act before she acts, and she's going to perpetrate new injustices under the guise of correcting past injustices. Now, this is not to say that women have not, in fact, been conditioned by past socialization. They have. All I'm arguing against is the notion that one has been victimized by it. Every woman's socialization and every man's socialization has limited us in particular ways. But it is useless and destructive for us to think of ourselves as the victim of that socialization. Now, looking at it from the other side, remembering that victim implies victor, if I decide that you are a victim, I think I'm really saying you're not fully human. You don't have control over your life, as I, of course, do. You're a victim. Poor you. I must help you. I am superior to you because I am not a victim. Here I would ask you to think about the concept of mental illness. which in my judgment is the most common and most dangerous way in which we transform people into victims. Mental illness. How do we know that a person is mentally ill? We infer it from behavior. But how can you infer mental illness from behavior instead of cowardice, fear, irresponsibility? How do you know that a person's doing... Well, here's an example. Alex Johnson, a baseball player. A couple of years ago, he played for a number of teams. He's a problem for the teams. And he was playing, I think, for the California Angels. And they benched him. And then they suspended him because he wouldn't run out ground balls and he wouldn't chase fly balls. He was goofing off. And his teammates resented him. He wasn't hustling. And did any of you remember what he did? He filed a suit claiming that it wasn't his fault. And he won. He got restitution and back pay. He claimed he didn't run out those ground balls because he was mentally ill. Now, you tell me any kind of antisocial behavior for which a person cannot claim mental illness as the cause. I think that's very dangerous. To infer mental illness from behavior is to absolve a person from all responsibility by saying that he's a victim, and all behavior can be absolved in that fashion. And then let me ask you, who's going to be left to do the absolving? Who's going to be left to define mental health and to do so responsibly? I think that the concept of mental illness is a device of unlimited usefulness for, on the one hand, absolving people of responsibility by defining them as victims, and on the other hand, for denying people their civil rights by claiming that they are not fully human. We do deny people their civil rights by claiming that they're mentally ill. And sometimes they say they're not mentally ill, and we say, yes, you are. And because you're mentally ill, we don't believe you. And the proof that you're mentally ill is that you deny it. Now, someone says, all right, this is all sounding suspiciously like conservative ideology. But calling attention, here comes my liberal friends, calling attention to the fact that people are the victims of society at least pushes society toward doing something about causes rather than dumping all of the costs on the unfortunate individuals. Right? You've heard that argument, haven't you? You say, well, look, those people who claim that individuals are responsible for their own poverty, what they want to do is abolish poverty programs. They don't want to deal with the root causes of poverty. I've thought about this a long time, and I've offered two conclusions about this. I think, in the first place, I think it is a fact that when we think we know how to deal with the root causes of a problem, we do so. And because we think that it's cheaper. And let me grant the assumption of the liberals, that we're always trying to save money. Right. When, I think this has been true for 150 years in our society, when we think we know how to deal with the root causes of poverty or crime or mental illness or any other, we do. We take the steps, we spend the money, we build the buildings, hire the specialists to do whatever is required. Quite a few times we've discovered that what we thought was a solution wasn't the solution at all. But that's the best evidence that when we think we got a solution, we go ahead. It's a cheaper way. Everybody recognizes, everybody knows by this time how much it costs to lock a person up in prison. It's fantastically expensive. It would be far cheaper to eliminate the causes. The problem is we don't know how. All right? So I don't think that it's very likely that we will refuse to pay attention to the causes of these social problems, or refuse to pay adequate attention to them, if we buy my view that we ought to stop thinking of people as victims. However, there's another side of it. Thinking of people as victims does cause us to diminish the burden of the consequences of their acts upon them. Thus, If we think that people are the victims of poverty, we give them aid. If we think they're the victims of unemployment, we give them unemployment compensation. If we think that people who commit crimes are the victims of a bad environment, we tend to give them suspended sentences, early probation, parole, and so on. And if we stop thinking of people as victims, we may stop doing that. In other words, we may stop cushioning the impact upon people of their own antisocial actions. Now, I don't know what to say about this, except I can point out a couple of things, that as we reduce the impact upon actors of their own actions, we do two things that are dangerous. We increase the perceived net advantage of antisocial action. Now, there are people who will say criminals don't weigh the costs and benefits. I think there's a mountain of evidence that shows that ain't true. Criminals do. Not all criminals. I don't think that a person who murders his spouse is carefully sitting there calculating, let's see, probability spouse murders second degree, probably 25 years, bang. There are indeed crimes of passion. But this argument has been made. A person who's holding up a liquor store, when he sees the proprietor reach under the counter, he doesn't stop and think. He just fires. So, you know, raising the penalty for homicide in the course of committing a felony isn't going to reduce it any, because that's an emotional response. Aha, but I think that's looking at the wrong place. But the time the person thinks about it is when he decides whether or not to take a gun along on this little act. Now, there are some crimes where it is indeed difficult to establish that criminals engage in calculations, but there are other crimes where it is impossible to deny that criminals engage in calculations of net costs and benefits. I was recently reading a study, I should have brought some figures along, but I didn't think of it when I came up here, on the expected annual income today from certain kinds of antisocial acts. Pushing drugs, $25,000 a year. Pickpocketing, $15,000. Well, you know, it's an advantageous career. And, of course, all of these statements now that young people make, who can be quite sure that they're not going to be sent up for any long stretch, that they'll just have their wrists slapped, if even that, they know that there's some costs, and they're low, and there's some advantages, and so they act. And the second thing that we do is we foster, by shielding people again from the consequences of their acts, we foster passivity among people who are designated as victims. And I think passivity is fatal. We just encourage people just to be passive, not to be actors, and to take no responsibility for their own lives. Now, again, if this all sounds too much like conservative ideology, let me assure you, first of all, that it is. Secondly, I think it is radical, in the sense of radix, root, radish, going to the root of the problem. I think going back to individual responsibility is going to the root of the problem. But thirdly, I would argue that while it may be bad Marxism, it's pretty fair Leninism. Lenin was quite concerned that people take responsibility, at least the elite, and it is excellent Maoism. Because Mao insisted that every person take responsibility for her actions. And I think Mao is a tremendous advance over Marx. Marx was a kind of a fatalist, an inconsistent fatalist, as all fatalists are. He was a fatalist who wrote inflammatory books, which fatalists should never do. But Marx has had a tendency to teach some radicals, some Marxists, current revolutionaries, that they must wait for the revolution. They must wait for the contradictions of capitalism to become so deep and so broad that the revolution automatically occurs, instead of looking into their own lives and their own environment and seeing what is to be done. Lenin taught the leaders, the elitists, that they must assume responsibility for history. And Mao said everybody's got to assume responsibility for history. There are no victims. Maybe Mao wouldn't agree with my way of putting it, but I'm not sure what all this entails for social policy, but I think it entails programs, social programs, that emphasize the power to choose and that and personal responsibility for choice. I think it entails something like a very radical democracy. I am quite certain that what I am saying in my own mind is terribly anti-elitist. I am becoming more and more anti-elitist. One of the things that has led me to this hostility toward the concept of victim is the fact that victim implies victor, and that I see our society moving increasingly toward a small group of professionals, self-designated leaders, thinkers, the only human beings who are left, who will so control life for the rest of us that we will be happy. And that's an abomination. I much prefer Ortega y Gasset's concept of the excellent person. We are all in here advantaged people. Those I've never denied that some people have more advantages than others. I do not deny the concept of the handicapped. That's a very different concept. A concept of the handicapped calls attention to limitations. It does not imply powerlessness. Dave, I was taken by what you said in Matins the other day, because Dave is handicapped, not powerless. And Dave spoke about power, and about the power of people. If you calling attention to a person's limitations, be careful you don't exaggerate them, maybe calling that person to realism, but they're also calling that person to a recognition of the base from which they can act effectively. Ortega suggests, he is warning in his book, The Revolt of the Masses, written back in 1932, he was warning that our society was becoming increasingly massified. Everyone was becoming mass man. And the mass man is somebody who is content with what he finds himself to be and says, there ain't nothing I can do about it, that's the way I am. So you say to the mass man, you are prejudiced. He says, yep, that's the way my mommy made me. Whatever he finds in his head is right. It's right because I feel it. And he expects civilization to be delivered to him from on high. There's nothing he has to do about it. If bad things come, he bitches. If good things come, he forgets to be grateful. He thinks it's just what's due to him. The excellent person is not the person who thinks he's superior to all of this, but is the person who recognizes that to him much has been given, and therefore from him much shall be required. Ortega defines the excellent man, and pardon the sexist language, but the excellent man is one who places himself under obligation, who is never satisfied with what he finds in his head. And I don't think that's elitism. The people in our society who have been given much, like us, ought not to claim for ourselves even more by deciding that others are victims, which implies that we are victors with a right to rule. We ought to recognize that our advantage imposes upon us a tremendous obligation. Obligation to do what? I don't know. Now, have I said anything controversial or clear?
Oh, no, just 9:15.
All right, what I would like to suggest, you can go any way you want to, I would like to suggest that you, if you want to, come up with some legitimate uses for the concept of victim. See if you can. I don't think you can.
I was just thinking you would use the term victim much in terms of criminals, you know, and that sort of thing. And I thought in some states where they see the person who has been attacked or robbed or shot as a victim, you know, you're walking down the street, some guy comes and clubs you. Mm-hmm. And as a result, in some states, for example, there's rather than simply throwing a person in jail on certain crimes, the person is forced to make restitution or go to jail and that sort of thing. But that, again, seems to me operates an idea. The person is a victim, and it's, in a sense, it seems to me to make sense that...
And there's a sense in which a person, like somebody, I am robbed. Now, in that sense, in some small respect, I have been conquered. My brass teapot is gone. It has been taken from me. I am the victim. But that's a very limited use of the concept. There's very little danger that we are going to think of the people who have been robbed as victims in the sense in which I'm talking about now, people who are powerless, who cannot control their lives, who have to wait for others to help them, except in some cases now, we are coming close to getting the people of the of large cities of thinking of themselves as victims who cannot even venture out onto the street. Now there comes the danger. I refuse to think that. I live in a large city and in an area that is called, was called when we moved in, unsafe. Now I'm a man and it's safer for men, although given the sexual preference of the people in my neighborhood, it might be. But actually, you know, there's rape seems to be confined pretty much to heterosexual males. But I don't know. I hope I would have. I don't feel unsafe. But darn it, I'm not going to allow myself to feel unsafe. I'm not going to be victimized by that. And I wish that the people see what happens is the people of an area where there have been some muggings and some assaults. They decide they are victims. The police must do something, or Washington must do something. And they lock themselves up in their apartments and wait for the world outside to act. They don't act themselves. Now, what could they do if they acted themselves? If they stopped thinking of themselves as victims, they could maybe get together. They could protect one another. They could work at creating the kind of neighborhood in which the crime rate declines, the kind of neighborhood in which people feel safe. When everybody feels like a victim and retreats inside, then indeed the streets are very unsafe. Am I speaking to your...
Yeah, I still say that some of these people are in fact victims. They're older people or people that have no awareness of even being able to organize or do anything like that. Now maybe if someone like you came in and informed them all, that would change. But I don't, you know, like if someone's 80 years old by themselves, they go out, they get beat, they get robbed. Those are the kinds of people that are being informed.
Yeah, well, I would prefer saying these are people with severe limitations. And people with severe limitations stand in need of much help from those who have lesser limitations. But I don't want to, I certainly would want to discourage in even an 80-year-old woman who walks with a cane from thinking of herself as the victim, which for me implies powerlessness.
I'm saying after the fact.
Yeah. All right.
He's talking about victim of event. I mean, that which you just, I think, talked to. There are two ways in which you use that word. If I now walk down that street out there and somebody clubs me over the head from behind, I am a victim of an act of clubbing. That's a description of what has occurred to me. I didn't cause that to happen to me. I am the victim of the clubber. But then if I then am afraid to walk on the street from then on, I become a victim in the sense of my being. I see myself as victim of anyone who might wander around. And you're talking more about people, victims of acts, and that's a difference. You're talking about a much larger sense here.
Yeah, and I wanted to comment. You're suggesting that people who have committed criminal acts be required to make restitution to people. I think that would be a very useful step to begin experimenting with to try to create in people again a sense of personal responsibility. The idea of making restitution is a good one, and I think it'll come back when we recognize once again the social indispensability of the concept of personal responsibility. I think you were next.
I just had one question, or one thought concerning victims. Aren't most of the victims, you're a victim of the moment, as opposed to, you know, sort of dwelling in the self-pity and the anger and carrying this out, and that those victims that go from victim back to fitting in to where they were before are those that can think somewhat creatively or courageously to sort of resolve their predicament, you know, like old people getting together and talking about, you know, how can we function in our community without feeling like we're victims. And the other question, reaction was to that pain, people making restitution. There are some crimes that can be, but if a person's career is oriented in the area of crime, if that's the skills that they have, then how can they possibly play restitution?
Yeah, I don't, there are limitations to that.
Those people that are working for, that were working for $2.35 or $2.50 an hour, and they've been programmed, you know, like look at television and see advertisements about driving new cars and having some of those things. So in order to that need or that dream, they need something big more, so they have chosen a new career.
Yeah, I would just point out that you're using the language of now of victims. Which is okay. I'm not necessarily right, but you were. You're talking about being programmed.
Which is a victim.
He, then you, and then you. That's the order of science.
About 10 years ago in New York City, in Williamsburg, where crime was very rampant, it was going through a transition, and there was a group who were called the Hasids, who indicated that they would no longer become victims of the roving gangs within the community. So they organized their own miniature police force, of which they then patrolled and apprehended the suspects, shook them down. And these were very pious people, and their concept was never again, because these had been victims, quote, from Warsaw, in the 39s and 40s. Crime disappeared outside from that area, from outside penetration. It also had the smatterings of the vigilantes. Now, are you saying that the vigilante approach, where there are no longer victims because we will control ourselves, is a concept that you endorse? Okay, that's one thing. The second thought is, what about the victimless crime, where a corporation steals society's money? A banker embezzles yours and my money, where we have no control. Someone writes checks, and there is really no victim person, but there's an organization that's victimized, or a society that's victimized, or a community that's victimized. A public official embezzles, or a police officer who takes bribe, or a judge. Within this thing, there are certain societies that have their own victimless society. The mafia is very good at this, because there is no victim in the mafia, because they use the Mercado approach. The punishment fits the crime, and therefore, you know what the punishment is going to be if you do something, and there they really take responsibility for their acts, and they're ready to accept the responsibility. See, but they still perform the act, recognizing that, you know, they can be bumped off, which they are. So there's a certain dichotomy in what you're saying. One is, I'm not so sure you approach it from the vigilante approach, that we all get together and decide that we're not going to have crime here by taking law into our own hands. Two is, what about the white collar non-victimized or crime against no individual? And the other is where the punishment fits the crime, where if you steal, you have to make restitution to the person. But if I have no money, I have to make restitution to you. If I stole from you, I have no money to give back to you.
I'm not suggesting that everyone can make restitution, or that this ought to be the first line of attack on the problem. I just suggested that it was, I think, in some cases, a useful way to go. I think it might be particularly useful with youth crime. But the second thing is, I'm puzzled by your use of victimless crime here. For me, victimless crime has always been a term applied to crimes in which all of the parties directly affected give their consent. If someone writes a bad check on my account, I'm not giving my consent. If a government official embezzles, the taxpayers are not giving their consent. The effects of being widely distributed. Victimless crime usually means things like prostitution, drug taking, gambling. Okay. Well, I don't have any comment to make on that. But on the vigilante thing, of course, to use the word vigilante is already to condemn it. Obviously, I'm not in favor of a vigilante approach. I am in favor of responsible community action. Now the question is, where's the line? I think we have much to learn from other countries. And I gobble up, whenever I can find them, good studies of crime and methods of dealing with it in other countries. And the country whose experience has been most instructive for me is Japan, which I don't know it firsthand. I know it only from studies that I've read. Japan has a good deal of what we might call, what some of us might call, vigilante behavior. But really, it's not very ferocious. The neighborhood does not actually punish the person. It just apprehends them. There's a lot of scolding that goes on. Even policemen do a lot of scolding. The policeman on the beat in Japan will apprehend the criminal and scold him on the spot. But there are lots of differences between Japan and the United States. The Japanese are taught, when confronted with authority, to submit, to do penance, and to be restored to the community. But the people in Japan tend to be parts of very definite communities. Their social status is given in large part by how they fit into a constellation of other people, and they're very concerned about their status in that group. Consequently, it is easier for a neighborhood or a private association of people to bring pressure to bear against criminal behavior without hanging or beating or anything like that.
It does have a stronger concept of faith.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But in any event, it clearly is possible for neighborhoods to take more responsibility for what goes on in their areas without going all the way over to lynch law. Dorset bear on this?
Yeah. A Lutheran pastor, a Japanese Lutheran pastor, we were there last summer, and we noticed how everybody left their bikes and motorbikes and everything on the street, no locks, nothing. And we mentioned it to this friend, who's a Lutheran pastor, why is it nobody steals these? You never do that in our country. You just leave your motorbikes and your bicycles out. And he said, Buddha's watching.
I suspect there's more to it than that.
That was his explanation. He's lived there all his life. But he said it's their religion.
Well, okay. Yeah.
When I think of victims, I think of victims of society. And this doesn't have anything to do with crime. And that's why I said the word rebellion when you asked. We're from Germany, and we went back for a visit. And we realized that most of our relatives are victims of society, and by this I mean, like my brother-in-law is a well-known architect in a certain part of Germany, and he has to wear certain clothes and drive a certain car in order to be accepted and to get orders. And this is much more bothering or painful than being a victim of. I can't explain it, but I felt it was. I would rebel, and they do. But some of them go along in order to survive.
Well, they make choices.
Yeah.
Therefore, they're not victims.
Yeah, but the other victims don't have choices.
Which ones?
Your kind.
Which kind?
The criminals.
I'm saying they do. Saying people do have choices.
Yeah.
I don't know anybody who doesn't have a choice. That's what I'm asserting. People do have choices. They may not like the choices they have. But if they think of themselves as victims, then they're not going to make effective use of the choices they do have. I find it a little difficult, given the plight of many other people, to be too sympathetic with an architect who has to maybe wear certain clothes in order to get orders. It seems to me that the choices he has to make are rather trivial, the choices he doesn't like to make. But if a person thinks of himself as a victim, like I know some people who work for IBM who are constantly griping about the fact that they have to wear a white shirt. I don't know, they still do. That was a couple of years ago when I was down at the IBM office. And they gripe about that white shirt. And they think of themselves as victims. And what impresses me about these people is how that concept of victim has made them passive. I'm not saying that they ought to burst out in colored shirts or something. It depends on whether they want to keep their jobs or not. But you can wear a white shirt with flair and with sassiness, or you can wear it in a craven fashion. I really want to go to the in order here. Yeah.
Do you think the courts today base their decisions more or less on personal responsibility?
I think, well, more or less than when? Less than in the 19th century. I think the courts are very uncomfortable with the concept of personal responsibility. And so I can find cases where courts hold things that suggest nobody's responsible for anything, and in cases where they're holding that everybody's responsible for everything. There's the interesting case in Madison of the judge who held the young man not guilty of raping the 15-year-old girl in the school because women nowadays wear such sexy clothes. So he was holding women in general responsible. He never even claimed that this girl. Now there's a concept of personal responsibility there, but there's also a concept of non-responsibility. He was holding that young man. He was sort of saying people aren't responsible. Males are not responsible for sexual acts, but women are responsible for the way they dress. Now you can find that's an extreme example, but I think you can find, if you read court decisions, you find evidence that the courts are as confused by the concept of responsibility as the rest of us. Somehow we know it's impossible to deny the fact that you can come up with a perfectly plausible explanation for every piece of behavior. And you can wind up there by saying nobody could help anything. You can do it. And sometimes we drift in that direction. And at other times we'll just say, doggone it, you got to choose. It's your fault, you've done it. Now I'm not sure after that who was next. There was that hand isn't up anymore. I think you were next. And then you and Earl, I saw you last. When did you come up?
I think after some of these.
Okay, maybe I should just let you talk.
It goes back to almost the beginning when you were talking about victims. And I think how you conceive victims goes back to the beginning of time. And the thought occurred to me that I wonder if society really wants to do away, quote unquote, with victims on the basis that we always have a part of us, whether it's a personal part of us or whether it's because of society, that likes to see a victim. Not because they like to see the position that they're in, but because I think there's always a little bit of us that says, I want to help the underdog. Another thing that occurs to me is the compassion trap. I think we all have a need, and maybe some of us more than others, to fall into what we call the compassion trap, where I am going to help my neighbor. And maybe we as Christians are even more, quote unquote, guilty, if you want to call it in those terms, than other people. That's just a thought that I have. So as far as I can see, as far as history, since time began, there's always been the victim and the victor. And I really wonder, if you think about it carefully, if we really would be pleased or happy or satisfied to see that there would be no victims, so that we could, maybe from a psychological or emotional standpoint, be happy with that situation as it is.
Okay. Well said.
I'd like to make an observation. I'd be interested in your response to it, and that is that it seemed to me for a long time that conservative ideology, at least as it's most frequently stated and applied, while emphasizing very strongly the notion of personal responsibility and that people have choices, has been unwilling to recognize that many people are very much disadvantaged, very much limited in their available choices. And as I could cite as an example, the status of many Indians on reservations close to where I live, who I think quite clearly are extremely limited in their choices, and the attitude of many people, white people in surrounding communities, that, well, why don't these people better themselves, and really an unwillingness to recognize just how great the limitations are.
No, I thoroughly agree. I think part of the problem is that people are uncomfortable in the middle. I mean, we're uncomfortable in tense positions, dialectical positions. We notice that people don't have, well, the conservative says everybody has a choice and concludes from that everybody has an equally good range of choices, which is nonsense. His enemy, we call him a liberal or what, notices that people have a very, very different range of choices. Some people have excellent choices, and some people have rotten choices, and concludes nobody chooses. And I think both positions are wrong. And maybe liberals of this side are made by too much crowing from conservatives on this side, who conclude that since everyone has the power to choose, therefore I am justified in doing what I please with what I have, and I have no responsibility toward others. But see, great, large endowment entails a large responsibility. My emphasis is on responsibility, not just the responsibility of the poor and the weak, above all the responsibility of the rich, not, as you said, not to fall into the compassion trap, not to treat these people as victims, hot diggy dog. but to try to make them victors, help them become victors, not teach them to be.
Castillo very much said that stealing and looting was bad. But then again, at the same time, the choices you could make to get away from the stealing and looting would still be very lousy choices. So just because a person chooses to make the best of a lousy choice, does that erase the fact that they're still victims?
It does in my book. I argued this out just recently in the context of blacks, and whether it is useful for blacks to think of themselves as the victims of past racial injustice. And the group which I was arguing this, I think we wound up all concluding that it is useless. This is not to deny that, again, the blacks, for example, have been today suffer disadvantages that were created by past racial discrimination. But I think that it is pernicious for blacks today to stress the effect of currently operating discrimination. I think that it's useless. It causes them to focus their attention in the wrong place. I think it is always bad. That is quite aside from the question of whether or not blacks are the victim of currently operating prejudices or to what degree they are. I don't think it's useful for them to focus their attention on that. It helps them to think as victims. And I think this was one of the great achievements of Malcolm X, that he, like no other black leader, with great charisma, taught blacks how useless it was to think of themselves as victims.
Paul, in that little speech, you sounded like you were saying that there may be victims, but it's bad to admit that.
Gotcha.
Well, I come back to the free will determinism. I don't know how to resolve that problem. I do. It may be that nobody has free will, but it is awful to make that assumption. It is far better to assume free will. It leads in better directions. I cannot deny the possibility that some people are absolutely conquered. I want to affirm the power that individuals do have. I want to strengthen individuals' sense of responsibility, whether they're at the top of the social heap or at the bottom. I want to tell people who have very little, who are feeling downtrodden, I want to tell them, don't fall into the victim trap. Don't think of yourself as a victim. It's not going to lead you where you want to go. Ask yourself what resources you do have and begin acting from those. You know, it's coffee break time, and some people may want to get something before it goes. I'm willing to stay here. I don't know how many of you will want to stay when everybody leaves, but there's some hands still up, so.
I would like to say that it's really not black and white. I, for one, would like to partially agree with what you said about the society and try to live without a victim. But it is not black and white. We have to tell people that if you have a bunch of bad alternatives to make a choice, try to select the best one, and then you have another choice. It's a whole series of choices before you get the best choices. And if you have made a decision on the bottom of the totem pole wrongly, at that point you can tell an individual that you made a mistake. Make a choice again. It is not that black and white. We have to make people aware. I feel that these are a bunch of decisions, the decision tree, before you get the good choices. And by simply saying, hey, I have a bunch of bad alternatives, that's why I don't make a choice, and that's why I'm a victim, I think it's an easy way out.
I agree. I don't hear you arguing with me.
Well, I started out by saying I, for one, would like to agree with what you said.
Oh, okay. Ron, you weren't satisfied. I'm going to go back to you. Yeah.
I have another question, and that is, do you think it's advantageous then to tell a person that, you know, say like a black person, I, for one, think it's kind of foolish to tell a black person that you know, this is a free country and that, you know, you can start out from nowhere and make your way to the presidency and something like Jimmy Carter or Peanuts going to the White House. Yeah, I don't think it's advantageous to tell anybody who's a minority that that's a possibility. I mean, you can tell them that it's a really slight, remote possibility. It seemed like to me it would be more advantageous to say, like, society is, in a sense, against you. But you have to work with those options. It's not to me, it would be just more advantageous to be practical and say, look, you know, this is against you, that's against you, and you will be victimized. But that doesn't mean that you should give up or throw your hands up or something like that. But to send a person out and say, you know, if you work hard and try hard, you'll do okay. That's a lie to tell somebody who is in the minority that, you know, that's a lie. But some people work twice as hard and get nowhere. Right? And it just seems to me that would be more advantageous than to say, if you really try and get in there and work with your options, things would get better.
I don't think we can ever predict for another person. I'm not running around telling blacks or whites that they can be president of the United States if they just hustle, or that they will necessarily succeed if they make effective use of the opportunities that they have. That's not what I'm suggesting. I am suggesting that it is useless to tell blacks what you wanted to tell them. Tell them that you're going to be victimized, you're going to find it hard. I really can't see where that's going to help anybody at all, particularly black people. The fact of the matter is, and we all know it, that being black is likely to mean some disadvantages. Why stress them to the black person? It's a different matter to stress them to white people, as long as it doesn't become then a subtle way for white people to assume that they are the dispensers of grace. It's the question of to what extent blacks are currently victimized in our society is a useful question for whites to talk about. I don't think it's a useful question for blacks to talk about. That puts it bluntly.
But I mean to, you know, to let that be a realistic option, you know, in the sense that realistically speaking, that's what your odds are in our work. You know, keep that in mind, you know, because it seems to me like it's very frustrating, you know, for me to go through life thinking that I can get as much out of the American system as, you know, one of my white male friends. You know, that's in.
Yeah.
To me, that would be setting myself up for a very great disappointment.
Caroline, the question is whether your position or Paul's position would create an Andy Young in terms of his attitudes and choices.
Well, I don't see Andy Young in any. I mean, he is where he is, but I think he's there because he was aware of the fact. You know, maybe in his mind, he thinks he ought to be president.
Or maybe compared to, if you average where Andy Young is in comparison to where a lot of his white male friends is that he went through the system with, you know, maybe he's at the bottom of the totem pole. My guess would be he's lower probably than where they are. So, but I'm not saying that he should just throw up and say I'm a victim. I'm just saying that would be a helpful option for him to keep that in mind, you know, to kind of...
Well, I think you pose the alternative very clearly. Is it a helpful option to keep in mind or is it not? I think we can leave it unsettled for now and people think about it. Barbara, and then back there.
I'm going to speak just directly to him and roughly say that these possibilities are available in our country because we have a friend who came from Lima, Peru. His skin is very dark, and in San Diego area, being a Mexican is equally as disadvantaged as being black. They're definitely considered second-class citizens. This young man came up without even a high school education with $300 in his pocket, a wife and a child, and absolutely no help. In 25 years, now has a multi-million-dollar business, only because he worked, not because he got any help, and because down there he was considered definitely a second-class citizen, but through long hours of hard work, he refused to accept the victimized policy. He said, anything I want to do, I can do, and he worked to do it. Now, true, he didn't have a lot of social life, and he didn't have a lot of amenities while he was working for this. But he is now an American citizen, he has a good business, and he has a heck of a lot more.
than a lot of, quote, white people that started out with many more advantages.
Yeah. I want to register a little discomfort with the direction in which we're now talking about success, because psychologically I think what you're saying is correct, and I disagree with what Berlin is saying, but I'm also unhappy with the concept of success that is assumed in what both of you are saying. I think one of the evidences of the decline of a sense of individual responsibility in our society is the definition of success in terms of status achieved relative to others. So that there is only one person who can be the most successful, and then there, depending on how the pyramid is structured, that success is achieved by climbing higher than others in terms of political power or income or something like that. And I think we need to develop in our society a concept of success that is much more socially aware, that is not achieved by besting others, but is achieved by, in Mao's term, grasping both ends to raise the middle. And that can be done. It can be done.
Well, I agree with you, and I feel that, to me, the most adequate term of, I mean, definition of success is to, for each person to establish their own goals, and whether or not they achieve those goals makes them successful.
Okay, but I want to add their responsible goals, in my judgment, and there are irresponsible goals.
Yeah, okay.
Okay. Ma'am, you before everybody leaves, quick.
I was just going to say a couple of things. The thing that mainly I keep feeling inside is that we're basically talking about options and what one does with them.
Mm-hmm.
And how one's mental state or looking at oneself prepares you to deal with the options that are available to you, whether they be presidency or much more limited. Seems to me that basically we are saying that it is more advantageous to sit down, take a good hard look at your situation, whatever it is, and say, now where do I go from here? And the concept of victim seems to me, I agree with you, to be the very antithesis of the ability to do that. Because you are looking at your options and saying, ain't it awful, I can't do a thing.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of saying, they may not be the options that Jimmy Carter had, but these are my options, what's the best I can do with them? Where do I go from here?
Go ahead, you, one, two, three.
It seems to me there is a point, or up to a point, there's a real usefulness in stressing to a disadvantaged person the fact that he is disadvantaged, and that is in up to the point where it helps him to realize the realities of his situation. Because I feel that perhaps one reason why many people in our society do feel like victims is because they've had drilled into them this notion for so many years that if they just keep plugging away, they'll get what they want, and without the disadvantages being pointed out, at which point when they don't get where they want as easily as they think they ought to, they do feel like victims. But of course, there is a line there where if you do keep stressing the disadvantages, the limitations a person may be up against, you may simply start feeling victimized by that. And that's a tough line to draw, but it seems to me you can't simply pull back completely from talking about the disadvantages that, for instance, blacks, Indians, and other disadvantaged people in our society have to deal with, because I think in order for any person to effectively deal with his options, he has to have a realistic idea of the limitations he is operating with.
I really wonder, though, coming back, whether any black person is ever helped to achieve his goals, whatever they are, by being aware of the fact of racial discrimination. I just wonder. Maybe he is, but there's a thin line here between realism and defeatism, realism and passivity. Bruce?
I don't want to leave confused. I feel like we've got three different things happening. One is an English class, in which you're saying we've gotten lazy about our use of the word victim when it means powerless. We've used it to mean many other things, and we'd like to preserve the true meaning of the word victim to mean powerless and nothing less than that or nothing more than that. I feel like we've also got a social analysis course going in which, you know, you're willing to admit that there are disadvantages and even severe limitations with which people live, and also a personal counseling class in which you want to say dwelling on those limitations or disadvantages is not helpful in living with disadvantages and limitations. Is that correct?
Well, I can never say that. You see, if you said it correctly in such a short period of time, why did I take so long? So there's the second. I would want to add something in that middle one, that in the social analysis, I think we have to pay attention to the social uses of the concept of personal responsibility. The courts are devices for inflicting costs on people for certain kinds of behavior, and the system of morality is something that inflicts costs, and it's a device that society depends upon for the maintenance of order, and the way in which we talk and think affects the values that are operative. So there's a good deal else at work there, and I guess the most radical, they're just that second, the social analysis is, I think, extremely radical, really, particularly if you remember that I thought the concept of mental illness is the most dangerous use of the victim concept. I'm really calling for a radical reordering of the way we carry on democracy. I've lived for a year now in the midst of what I would call lightheartedly an unfenced funny farm. I'm more persuaded now than I was a year ago that we are, the concept of victim is rendering a majority of our population passive, impotent. In various areas of life, we all have our little areas of impotence or passivity. And I think this becomes blatant in the case of those who are labeled mentally ill. Now, if you start asking yourself, what is the alternative approach to the problems of, quote, mental illness, and I think you begin to discover some of the radical implications of what I'm saying this morning.
I understand there that kind of whole self-fulfilling prophecy routine, and if I think of myself as a victim long enough, sure enough, I become powerless.
But there's more to that. Society also is a powerful. Society is an agency that enforces its labels. How do we reconcile order, which implies coercion, with democracy and the non-writing of scripts for individuals?
So I can also steal somebody else's power by labeling them a victim.
That's right. Yes, indeed. But you was a good summary, and I should have just bowed.
I'd like to say that I agree with all of that. My difficulty is coming back to sort of a realism factor. The danger I see is going from an understanding of victim as powerlessness to an understanding of victim as powerful, and that there's the possibility of falling into a kind of triumphalism that says if you stop thinking of yourself as victim and start thinking of yourself as victor, that in the categories in which we have defined those things in our society, you're going to be as powerless as you are if you think of yourself as victim. And that is what I think I heard Laverne saying. There is a realism factor which is not defeatism, which is not give-up-ism or victim, but you can't just flip that coin over and say, I'm going to be victor and I'm going to triumph, because it isn't true.
I agree. I don't want us to replace the victim mentality with the victor mentality.
Yeah, and I guess what I wish is that we could do some exploring of that, of the victor mentality, because I think as an American, we tend to categorize that in some ways that are equally as dangerous and equally as dehumanizing as the victim.
Yeah, I think...
Mind than anything, being a victim doesn't apply at all how bad a victim you are. Whether you got your head cut off or, bad example. Or look at the other side, being a victor doesn't apply at all that you are victorious over something great. It's a question of how big is a ballpark to start with. So therefore, you have to, if you have a certain part of choices, you make it. And with this, you are a victor. Whether you are a victor of something small or not, that's part of the handicaps you were talking about earlier. That has nothing to do with the victim concept itself. You had a victory. You are a victor. If you make a little decision, you make the right one. And then the next time around, you make a bigger one, a bigger victor. If you want to mesh that that way. So therefore, it's a question of handicaps, not of defeatism or anything like that.
What were you going to say then?
Well, I just like to say that that's true. I think depending on what your vision of society is, and it seems to me as Christian people, we have a vision of a shalom society, which everybody has enough, that says your choices and your victories are not, you know, sort of big or little. They are towards the fullness of life.
I think what you were saying is not is looked at, and you started asking, did I say anything controversial? I think it's much more serious than that. It's really the state of mind which makes the majority of people think I'm a victim is absolutely dangerous to our total society. So therefore, rather than saying, did I say anything controversial, we should find a strategy to overcome that. And we have to overcome this, I think, by making people aware it's a question of building things, of going from one step to the next step. Evaluate your handicaps and make a decision within that, and by doing so, become an active part of that society again, rather than this gelatine of growing mass of victims. They're sitting around and saying, I'm born and broken, so that's already the end of my life. I might as well go shoot people because I'm now a victim. Mm-hmm. And somebody will find an excuse for me. So I think what I'm trying to say is the other side of your story is rottening us out. Is rottening society. The victim side of the story is rottening us. We have to find a way to overcome that. And so we have to find a strategy which absolutely doesn't sound controversially, but logical within the building states of our society.
I quite agree. I like what you're saying. And when I asked whether I'd said anything controversial, I felt that if I had not, I probably wasn't clear. That's all. No, but I very much like your emphasis on getting people to build something.
Yeah, but doesn't it have to be building within a context?
And sure.
You can talk about building within the context of the United States or of any other country, and if you take that as a given, as an okay world, then your choices are going to be very different than if you have a vision of a society that is very different from ours.
But I think if your vision is too large, you'll never find anything to do, and you're going to feel victimized. One of the things that makes people feel victims is that they can't move, I think, until they solve the problems of the world.
Is there a simple thing that we can direct ourselves to right now? Because I think what we're saying is that as we begin to encompass all society, we feel kind of helpless. I feel helpless. And how can I deal with the international situation? I just have a discussion with my family. I said, I was responsible for major decisions. My wife was responsible for the minor decisions. She had the children, the money, the house. I had international warfare.
Yeah.
I had climate conditions internationally. I didn't have to deal with anything. Let me say a very simple thing. If whenever you feel you are a victim, you do something at the moment and find that you are no longer a victim, but you are in control of that moment.
So yeah,
that power that you have, which is going to restore, it's very simple. You have your car fixed and you put a new muffler on. As you drive out and you're down 100 yards away, the muffler falls off. And you say, crap, I'm
There's nothing I can do about it. I'm angry, and you go off, and you kick the cat, and you beat up your wife, and you write the empty letter to the editor. You say, hey, the man put a muffler on. I paid my money. It took that man 1 hour to put the muffler on. It took me 6 hours to earn that money to pay the 1 hour that he put on. I'm going to go back to the man and say, hey, you put a muffler on. Would you please, when you put the muffler on, I assumed it was going to be a good muffler. It didn't last. Please replace the muffler. I have no charge to me. And the man says, thank you, I will. And he doesn't. You say, hey, I'm no longer a victim. I won, right? Therefore, I can go away with a certain amount of self-esteem, restoration, saying that I no longer have to be a victim. Now, if you take that one instance and you expand it in the course of your daily life, you will find that all of the so-called victimizing kinds of situations are corrected. And once that power is restored in you, that you are not a victim of the milkman that leaves a half-empty bottle, or your child that says things to you which you don't really care about, that you can do something about it, you then begin to expand the so-called horizons, and you may meet with other people who deal with neighborhood problems, or you might deal with politicians who deal with community problems, or national figures with national problems. And you deal with that, and it begins to work for you. And that little power that you gain is very contagious. They call it assertiveness, okay? Simple word. But there's another point that I kind of felt that...
This is going to have to be the last point because Joanne wants to
take this
room over.
Because I'm going to start giving points.
She wants to ring the bell.
I'm going to get aggressive.
Very briefly was that when we all take responsibility for ourselves, which I agree with, that you know we must assume responsibility for ourselves, at what point do we consider the consequences of those acts, of that responsibility? The consequences. That I can make a decision about anything I want to, as long as I recognize the consequences of that decision, be it good or bad. I may get it and I may not get it. It may be good for me, but not so good for somebody else. That's where it gets a little confusing. Because my responsibility to myself may be dead to you.
You yield the chair.